Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno from CNN, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's away and plans to be back with you on Friday of this week. In the 1930s, a prominent psychiatrist wrote influential papers about Huntington's disease in early America. Percy Vesey described those afflicted with the neurological disorder as scoundrels and outcasts who were viewed as, and I'm quoting here, living examples of sin. My guest today decided to do a little digging of her own and found that some of those people were community leaders in their day. Alice Wexler joins me in the studio to explore how community, science, and the eugenics movement shaped the experience of Huntington's disease in America. Her new book is titled The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease. Welcome to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Define for us first, to get us started, what is Huntington's disease?
Huntington's is an inherited neurological disorder characterized by involuntary movements called chorea. That's really the most dramatic symptom, along with emotional disturbances such as severe depression, irritability, and cognitive losses over a period of 10 to 20 years, usually starting in the 30s or 40s, but it can come much earlier or much later. And it affects people of all races and ethnicities. It's been reported in countries around the world.
And many famous people have suffered from Huntington's disease.
Well, perhaps the most famous is Woody Guthrie, who had this illness and died in 1967.
And it cuts close to home for you?
It cuts very close to home. My mother, my grandfather, my uncles, cousins all had this disease.
Cousins, uncles, plural?
Yes.
So growing up and being in this family for you and seeing all these people afflicted, what must that have been like?
Well, it was a big secret.
It was a secret? You didn't know?
We didn't know. My sister and I didn't know. My mother never spoke of it. We lived far away from our uncles. We didn't know what was the matter with them. And this was very common in families with this disease.
What is it about Huntington's that has, and we'll get into this some more, but even recently in your family experience made this sort of the dread and disguised disease?
Having something hereditary in the family, especially if it has any kind of mental component, you know, has for centuries been a kind of stigmatized condition. So the fact that it's very hereditary, transmitted from parent to child, is one of the reasons for the stigma. And also, you know, it's a very visible, dramatic illness, and it has elements of emotional disturbance, mental illness, long-carried stigma.
So when you see this in your family, and you know it's a hereditary disease, you must think, well, what about me?
Of course.
What chances do you have of contracting this disease?
Everybody that has a parent with the disease has a 50-50 chance of inheriting it.
So you have a 50-50 chance of inheriting it?
Yes. As you grow older, the odds go down. But because it's inherited what is called a dominant disease, every child has a 50-50 chance.
Can you be tested to determine whether you're likely and more, you know, on one side of the 50 or the other?
Yes, you can get tested now since 1986, thanks really to my sister, who led a big team of researchers who identified first a genetic marker and then a gene for Huntington's.
So a gene can actually identify whether you're in line for this fate?
Yes.
Have you had testing, if I may ask?
I have not been tested. This is a very personal, private question. And, you know, we feel strongly that people should not have to declare whether they're tested or not tested. Because actually, if you have the gene, that does not mean that you at that moment have the disease. You can carry the gene for many years, be perfectly healthy. Only when you start to have clinical symptoms, that's when you actually have the disease.
I asked you that question not to put you on the spot and because I know you were prepared to talk about it, but also because it reveals a very, very interesting ethical and moral and personal decision about the availability of this information and what happens with it.
That's correct. And I think we're in a time lag now because You can get this information, but medically it has no benefit. You can't do anything about it. I mean, obviously people have many reasons for wanting this information, psychologically, for family planning, and so forth. It's very variable, but from a medical point of view, at this moment in time, there's nothing that you can do.
Now, we should say, and I'm going to get to your book in a minute, which flashes us back, but as a friend of mine pointed out to me, and I watched the show, too, on House. Many people have seen the show. One of the doctors, one of the stars of the show, is actually dealing with the knowledge that she's going to get this disease and die. What does that do when something like this becomes part, in a sense, of pop culture?
It's interesting, actually, because if the representations are accurate, I think that's a way a lot of people learn about genetics and science, you know, from popular culture. Often, the disease is not represented very accurately. I mean, somebody can carry this gene, but they can function perfectly well. You know, it's only when they actually start to have difficulties functioning that it becomes an issue. But the fact that somebody has the gene should not make the difference.
Let me just mention to our audience, if you want to join our conversation with Alice Wexler, our author here of The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease, feel free, please, to email us at drshow@wamu.org. Call us at 1-800-433-8850. We'll get to your emails and your calls later in the program. Let's go to the book. The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea. This is a remarkable and riveting story. Who was this woman?
This woman, Phoebe Hedges, was an ordinary white woman who lived in East Hampton, Long Island, born at the end of the 18th century, into a quite prominent family, actually. And the way we know about her is that she walked into the sea, committed suicide in 1806, and the notice of this appeared in the newspaper. And in a sense, she walked into history when she walked into the sea. And the newspaper indicated that she committed this act because of her great dread of what they called St. Vitus's Dance, and noted that her mother had the same condition. And this was the same family. Her children and grandchildren were the patients of George Huntington and his father and his grandfather. George Huntington was the East Hampton physician who wrote the classic description of the disease in 1872.
Now, what you find and what you talk about are the ways in which this disease was referenced by others, including the preacher in the town. Talk about that, because it's quite remarkable.
The town, you know, this is a very small town. People all knew each other. So this was not a hidden disease, but it was a very secretive one. I think we have a situation where the disease was greatly feared, but the people at that time were not stigmatized on account of it. And the children and the grandchildren of Phoebe Hedges were town supervisors, they were whaling captains, they were part of the town council, you know, they occupied very prominent positions. So they were accepted and integrated. On the other hand, the disease was not considered appropriate to talk about.
And it was not appropriate to talk about because?
Because it was so feared and frightening. And to talk about it would be to call the families into notice. It would give them notoriety.
The thing that's amazing to me is that that this sort of mythology around this persisted for a very long time. And you actually quote from fairly recent times a prominent psychiatrist who wrote major papers on this by the name of Percy Vesey, I think. Is that right?
Yes.
And he described it, if I've got this right, as he described people who suffer from it as scoundrels, outcasts, suspected witches, living examples of sin.
Now remember, he was talking or claiming to talk about the 17th century.
And how they were viewed at that time.
At that time, yes. Although he was also implying that there was some of those attitudes persisted. But he had traced back the ancestors of his own patients to the 17th century. He wanted to find out, look at the first people who might have brought this disease from England to America.
And what was the point of that comment? I mean, to talk about witches and living examples of sin suggests a sort of a red mark, right? I mean, talk about loaded language.
Yes, it was very loaded language. Again, Percy Vesey was a eugenicist. He believed that people with these kinds of hereditary conditions should be sterilized. But again, he was looking back, and he speculated that the women in New England who had been accused of witchcraft might have suffered from Huntington's, and that the men around the women were also delinquents, criminals, antisocial types. But he wasn't a historian. He was a psychiatrist.
So what did they do with people who suffered from this disease back then when they believed that this was some kind of strange form of witchcraft or an extension of that?
Well, I think they even back in the 17th century, people had a concept of naturally caused disease.
So they didn't think they didn't directly think from your investigation, from your research, that these people were possessed and needed to be burned at the stake or anything? Horrible like that?
No, they didn't. Although, you know, again, one of the points that I was trying to make is that the meanings of this disease varied from community to community. So there may well have been places where people were regarded as possessed, or that their illness was caused by witchcraft. Not that they were witches, but that they were the victims of witchcraft.
What's the origin of the term St. Vitus's dance?
St. Vitus was a saint, you know, who was martyred in the 4th century, I believe, and he vowed that anyone prayed to him would be protected from the dancing disease.
We're talking with Alice Wexler about her book, The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Stay with us. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane will be back with you on Friday. We're talking now with Alice Wexler. She's author of The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease. Alice Wexler, take us back to the 1760s, the late 18th century, when this woman walked into the sea. This is a true story. Do we know, did you find out anything about her and her writings, her fears? Were you able to uncover what was going on in her troubled mind at that time?
There are traces of her life. No, she did not write anything herself. If she had not walked into the sea, we would probably know nothing about her. All we know that she saw a doctor several times before she did this, that he prescribed medicine for her, that he gave her advice. We have to infer that she was very distressed at that time. So we get these pieces of her life, you know, but we have to draw some inferences from that.
But it clearly captivated you. It propelled you into this investigation.
Yes, because it's so hard to find out about families. You know, we know a lot about doctors who have written about Huntington's disease, but I wanted to know, well, what about the families they were writing about? You know, who were they? How did they live? What, even if the traces are very slight.
Some questions from the audience. Here's one from David in Virginia, Alexandria, Virginia, that you said that even though the person has the gene for the disease, that disease may not develop for a long time. What's known about what causes the disease to become active, in his words?
That's a very good question. We don't know exactly what specifically triggers the development of the symptoms when somebody crosses over from being basically very healthy and normal to having very disturbing symptoms. But we know that the disease is caused by an expansion in a particular gene, and ultimately that creates an abnormal protein that then has harmful effects on the cells in the brain.
What's done for treatment today?
There are many treatments. Huntington's may be incurable, but it's definitely treatable. The depression can be treated. The symptoms can be treated as symptoms.
And the depression is part of the disease, or yes. Is the depression a result of having the disease?
Well, it could be both, but it's definitely part of the disease. It's a definite symptom, physiological symptom of the disease. Chorea can also be treated. In the involuntary movements, it used to be called Huntington's chorea because of this like choreography. That can be treated. In fact, a drug was just approved by the FDA called tetrabenazine, which has been used for over 30 years in Europe and around the world and will soon be available in the United States.
Why has it taken us 30 years to do what they're using in other places?
Good question. It was not approved here, despite has a long track record of use in other countries.
How many people do we think in the United States have Huntington's disease?
About 30,000 people actually have the symptoms, another 150,000 at 50% risk.
So that's immediate family members or children, actually, of people
yes.
who've had the disease.
That's right.
People who've had the disease or people who have the gene for the disease? Is there a distinction or a difference?
30,000 who actually have the symptoms, who have the active disease.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about George Huntington, the influence of the paper he wrote on the disease that came to bear his name.
He wrote this beautiful paper that described in just a few paragraphs the movement disorder, the depression, and cognitive symptoms.
And this was when?
This was in 1872. And it's remarkable that he was 21 years old, just out of medical school. But he really had learned about the families from his own life experience growing up in East Hampton with a father and his grandfather who were also doctors.
Is there something special about East Hampton and this concentration there? Are there we talk about cancer clusters. Are there Huntington's clusters?
No, it's just the happenstance of who migrated there, who settled there, the fact that it was a very stable community over a long period of time.
And what do you know about the origins of the disease, how this thing develops?
How this developed?
How
originally?
No, well, yeah, where it came from, or is there anything known about that in the science and the research?
Yes, we know that it is Huntington's is an expansion of a normal gene on chromosome 4, and that expansion can just happen, by happenstance. It's random, and once it expands, then it can be passed on from generation to generation.
Now, initially, this whole notion of hereditary disease was not something that was well understood, but that started to develop, as I understand it, sort of in the 18th and 19th centuries. Can you talk about that?
Well, the idea of hereditary disease goes way back to ancient times. Mental illness, insanity, as it was called, has always been regarded as hereditary or having a hereditary component. Just how the heredity works was not understood until the late 19th century.
And so how did that evolution of thought and understanding take place?
Well, partly because of Darwin came along, and he published a theory of natural selection, which made the question of heredity much more important. Lots of breeders, were also studying heredity for commercial reasons, and there were social theories about heredity that brought the whole issue to prominence in the late 19th century.
And something called degeneration theory.
Yes.
What's that?
Degeneration theory is the idea that over generations, the tolls of civilization are going to weaken society until certain families will simply die out.
So real evolution of...
De-evolution. Devolution.
And what was the debate between soft and hard heredity?
Soft heredity was what everybody believed in the 19th century, which is the idea that acquired characteristics could be transmitted to the next generation. So if you had, education or advantages, those would be passed on biologically. But if you had disadvantages or physiological trauma, those could be passed on too. Hard heredity is the idea that you only can inherit from your parent what your parent has inherited biologically from their parent.
Now, we were talking about—I get it. I'm following this. Talk a little bit about as well, if you would, since we know it's hereditary and we can test for the gene and there are new medications, are there—if you know that you're at risk, is there something that you can do or should do to improve your prospects?
At the moment, the only things that you can do can improve your well-being. They can't stop the action of the gene. They can't stop or slow the development of the disease, but they can make you feel a lot better.
So do you do anything? I mean, I'm sure you eat well and get lots of exercise and rest, as we're all supposed to do. But
yes.
But are there things that you do to protect yourself?
I do all those things that you just mentioned. Eat well, exercise, have a full life, and, you know, live now. Don't put off your life. What everybody should do.
I would agree with that. We take care of a lot of issues, from Huntington's to obesity, if we did all those things for all the right reasons. How did the eugenics movement influence people with how people with Huntington's were treated?
When the eugenics movement came along in the early part of the 20th century, I think it deepened the shame and stigma surrounding Huntington's.
Deepened the shame and stigma.
It deepened it. I don't say that it created it, but it certainly made things a lot more difficult.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but just before you go too much farther, just define eugenics for people who may not be familiar with it.
Okay. Eugenics was a very popular movement in the early 20th century to so-called improve the human race through better breeding, as they said. That is to say, to encourage so-called superior people to have lots of children and to discourage so-called defectives people or less desirable to have few children. The problem with eugenics is that those criteria were very much based on race, on class, but also on genetic conditions such as Huntington's. That was one of them.
Back then to eugenics and Huntington's.
Okay. The eugenics movement was very popular, espoused by intellectuals, university presidents, doctors, et cetera, et cetera. And it added to the stigma and made people more ashamed of having this to create the feeling that they didn't deserve to exist, you know.
We're talking with Alex Wessler. She's author of The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease. We have a number of phone calls. I'd like to go to one of them now. Carolyn from Hawthorne, Florida, thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate your waiting so patiently. And go ahead with your question.
What is the chances of you getting this disease if you either do not have or do not know of anybody in your family having it?
Okay. Alice, let's ask you to take that one on. What are the chances of getting this disease if you don't? Let's take it in two parts.
Yeah.
If you don't have anybody in the family.
If you know that you don't have anybody in the family, you have zero risk.
Zero.
Sometimes, because of the secrecy, people don't know that it's there until somebody's actually diagnosed in the family, and then that has implications for other people in the family as well.
Now, Carolyn, the caller, mentioned before she got on with us that she thought maybe she had some symptoms. What should happen there?
She should go to see a good neurologist who knows something about Huntington's disease and get a neurological exam, because that's the way the disease is diagnosed.
I want to go to another call here. Elaine from Newmarket, Maryland. Hello, Elaine.
Hello. I was just wondering, what is the connection between Huntington's and St. Vitus? I thought St. Vitus, isn't that the same thing as Tourette's? And if you have Tourette's, does that mean that you have a higher chance of having Huntington's?
Thanks, Elaine.
No. St. Vitus dance does not refer to Tourette's, although the term St. Vitus dance is often used to describe a lot of different conditions. I haven't heard of it being associated with Tourette's. Often it's more commonly St. Vitus dance is used for a childhood disease that we don't have much of anymore, that was went away by itself. So it was not so much of a problem.
Back to the eugenics movement. We'll come back to the phones in a few minutes. There's some more people waiting, but I do want to come back. We were talking a moment ago about eugenics.
Yes.
And you wrote about Charles Davenport and the influence Charles Davenport had at the beginning of the 20th century.
Charles Davenport was a very prominent scientist. He was a biologist. He was the head of the biological laboratory at Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island, PhD, in zoology, very influential. And he did one of the first big studies of Huntington's disease, and he believed in sterilization. So he was very prominent in spreading these kinds of eugenic ideas.
So he actually, in a sense, validated that practice, or at least promoted it?
He definitely promoted it, yes.
And it as I was reading, this is something that was used a lot in Nazi Germany.
Well, Nazi Germany was the most extreme case, obviously.
This is really disturbing to read this. It's just another horrific thing that took place under that regime, but talk about that.
Yes, I think that people often think that associate eugenics with Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, and they're not so aware of the prominence of the eugenics movement and its influence in the United States, and the fact that sterilization, involuntary sterilization, was practiced in state mental hospitals in the United States, and something like 60 or 70,000 people, most of them women, were sterilized over the course of the 20th century.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking with Alice Wexler, author of The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea. I'm Frank Sesno. If you'd like to join our conversation, please dial us, call us at 1-800-433-8850. I'd like to go to the phones now and ask Kate from Florida to join us. Hi, Kate.
Oh, hi. Yes, my mother, grandmother, uncle, and aunt all had this Huntington's chorea. And I'm the youngest of five children, three of whom have it. And luckily, I don't have it, and also my middle sister doesn't have it. So I just wanted to thank... I'm sorry, I've forgotten the name.
Alice Wexler.
Alice?
Yes, Alice.
Thanks, Alice, for bringing it to the attention of everyone, because, like you said, it's very secretive. We were never told as children that our grandmother had it. And I just remember my mother, around when I was about 12, she used to trip a lot and people thought she was drunk, and then her arms started flailing everywhere. And it's just like a socially unacceptable disease. So
do you still feel that way?
I feel that a lot of people don't know what it is. If you see someone walking down the street with it, it is very disturbing. You know, you grimace a lot. Your arms and legs just kind of fly out everywhere. It's a very strange thing to witness. So if the more people know about it, then I think the more, you know, people will go, oh, that must be Huntington's, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the other point I just wanted to make was because I don't have it, then there's no chance that my children can have it. It doesn't skip a generation. So I was very lucky in that respect.
Correct.
Thanks very much, Kate. Alice, you want to talk about that? And children, yeah, of children?
Yes. Thank you very much for your very moving comment. And you're right. Once you don't have it, you can't pass it on, and it will never come back in your line. But I think that it's really important for people to understand more about Huntington's and movement disorders such as this, to understand that it's a neurological condition. It's not drunkenness. This was a very common association. And that if more people are understanding, I think that at least can ease the burden of secrecy and stigma that just adds to the misery of the illness.
Back to popular culture and House and all this other business. Has there been public education surrounding this? I mean, if this is a disease and people, we just heard from somebody who feels that it's still stigmatized, still not understood. We have all kinds of public service announcements and public education about different diseases to destigmatize those and inform people. Has there been such a thing with Huntington's disease?
Yes, there's been quite a bit, actually, but obviously not enough. I mean, we need more so that people can really understand and grasp the meaning of a disease like this, yes. And I think popular culture can help. I think, program like House, it's been on a lot of different TV shows, in fiction, novels, and so forth. All of that is great.
And your book, and getting out and preaching from the mountaintops. I want to ask you one other question. As you go around with this book and talk to people, you know, we're hearing from people here. We have more on the phone. We'll get to them in just a moment. What kind of response do you get?
Well, again, the book has just come out, so I'm just at the beginning of this.
Okay, all right. I don't want to rush things then.
but actually, what Kate was saying, I think it's a relief to be able to talk about it. And the more, because people have in the past been very isolated by the secrecy, and so being able to talk, communicate, and what we have felt, because I've been involved with this for the past 40 years, really, that we have a big community. You know, it's actually a worldwide community of people. They're not, you know, not everybody's connected to it, but there is a lot of connection going on, and that helps.
I must say that when you were talking a moment ago about a new drug that's been approved by the FDA that's been available in Europe for 30 years, one wonders just how urgent this is on the public policy side and at the FDA and elsewhere.
Well, that's right. I mean, you're absolutely right. It should have been approved a long time ago.
The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea is the book. Alice Wexler is the author. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By the Wallace Foundation, whose Knowledge Center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. And by the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as we wait to see if Congress will pass a bailout plan, we take a historical look at Wall Street and government regulation with Stephen Fraser, the author of several books about the history of Wall Street. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno from CNN and the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane today. She plans to be back with you on Friday. We're talking with Alice Wexler. She is author of The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease. We have a number of people on the phones, and a number of emails, and I'd like to get to them with you, Alice, if I can. Here's one from Johnny, who says, the Woody Guthrie Festival annual in Oklahoma supports the research to fight Huntington's. Woody's life was taken prematurely by this terrible disease, and all the musicians and artisans donate 100% of their time for the benefit, he says. Mm. It's one of the few free festivals left in this country and celebrates not only one of America's greatest writers, but a great cause. Pass the word.
That's fabulous. Yes. Fantastic.
And it's certainly something that should raise some awareness. But it ties right into the next email that I'd like to read that's a little bit more disturbing. And this one comes from a listener who says, my brother is a researcher of the Huntington's disease at Harvard Medical School. He often says that compared to Alzheimer's disease, the funding is not as available for the research. What can be done to increase the funding?
We're working on that. I'm on the board of the Hereditary Disease Foundation that my sister Nancy Wexler, a researcher, is president of, and that's exactly what we're working on, to increase funding for research to find a cure for Huntington's. So it's something that we've been involved with and working hard on for a long time.
Let's go to the phones here. And, well, before I go to the phones, how are you doing? You say you're working on it. How are you doing? Are you getting money?
We're getting money, and I think one of the important points is that research on Huntington's has implications for Alzheimer's, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, and Parkinson's as well. So I think that Huntington's research implicates a lot of other illnesses.
Where's most of that research being done? Is it concentrated in certain key medical centers or universities?
It's actually being done all over the world. I mean, major medical centers, yeah.
But what, we need more money for that? That's what you hear from the researchers?
Absolutely, yes, because they're fantastic, hypotheses and theories that are being tested right now, but of course, there's never enough money for that.
Janet joins us from San Marco, Texas. Hi, Janet.
How are you?
I'm just great. Thanks so much for calling.
My question concerns the triggering mechanism. I'm wondering if anybody's investigated the possibility that different genes require different nutrients, and perhaps the delayed onset of Huntington's in most people has to do with this nutrient all of a sudden reaching the deficiency point, and then that triggers the swelling of the gene, which causes the disease. I just think it's something worth looking into, because this is true in a few other diseases I know.
Okay, Janet, thanks very much. Alice Wexler, what do you know about that?
Well, you're born with the disease that's already expanded, if you have that. The gene is the same all your life. But at some point, in other words, you can live with this expanded gene for 40 years and before it starts to show any symptoms. So there are some theories about cholesterol in the brain that's related to that. It's an interesting thought.
We had a caller who called in and said his relative, Andy Warhol, had St. Vitus at the age of 5. You know anything about that?
Yeah, that's the childhood kind of St. Vitus dance that is technically known as Sydenham's chorea. That is, after somebody has rheumatic fever, they often develop these involuntary movements, but they would go away after a while.
So what do you know about Andy Warhol's condition?
That he recovered and he was fine.
And obviously it was not Huntington's?
It was obviously not Huntington's.
Okay. If I got it right, Kiko from Fort Lauderdale, Florida?
Yeah, Kiko.
Kiko, thanks very much for waiting so patiently. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, no problem. I have Buerger's disease, which is a vascular disease. And my question to Alex, is her name?
Alice, yeah.
Okay, Alice. Due to my vascular system collapsing and stuff, I've had some auto amputations of like the tips of my extremities, like my toes and my fingers and stuff like that. So obviously my hands are deformed and are one of the very first things that other people see when they meet you and stuff. And for a long time, I had my own stigma about the deformity of my hand, but it was a vanity thing. And I wanted to understand something. I don't have that anymore, but I wanted to understand something. You had said when the host asked you about, have you been tested to see if you have the gene, you were semi-hesitant. And I wanted to understand, in this day and age, now that we understand, now science has shown, you know, that diseases can be cured and if you're not in a certain class, you can't get it, you know what I'm saying? And so, like, it's very, we have a lot of knowledge nowadays.
So your question is why didn't...
My question is, why is there the fear for you allowing, I guess, being that you're a front runner for this disease, for the cure of this disease or the fight for it, why the fear of totally exposing yourself in terms of whether you have it or whether you don't? I really don't want to disrespect you.
All right, well, let's see what Alice has to say about that. Thanks, Kiko, for your question. Tough one.
I think that's actually a very valid question. I wanted to just refer to something you said at the beginning. I think one of the reasons I wrote this book is that I wanted to really bring a disability rights perspective to it, because I think this issue of stigma and so forth applies to many different kinds of impairments. In terms of the fear of disclosing, yes, you're right. I did have a kind of hesitation. I don't think it's a fear of disclosing. It's my feeling that this is confidential information that people and families with Huntington should not feel compelled to disclose, whether or not they've taken the test. That's their business. That's private. There's nothing to be ashamed of one way or the other. And I agree that, you know, we need to work on that. Yeah.
Part of Kiko's question was, if you know, given all the research and medical expertise perhaps that's out there, even though there needs to be more, the implication anyway is that you can do something or you can, you know, improve your prospects by knowing. True? False?
Well, I don't agree with that, actually. I think we tend to have a feeling in this country if there's a technology out there, we should use it. We're very activist. But I think that there's a difference between information and knowledge. And, yeah, we could get this information, but why? You know, what are we going to do with it? I don't think just because a technology exists that it's always a good thing to use it. And I think that the choice not to get this information is not denial, it's not shame or fear, it's an active choice.
To Mary from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Mary.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question is about the other aspect of fear. There are so many different ways that you can be fearful if a genetic disorder is in your family. I have something in my family, it's not Huntington's, but one aspect of the fear for me in getting information about it is health insurance coverage. Knowing that a switch in your health insurance, you can't ask your doctor in a way about a genetic disease because it would go in your record of, I don't know that that's a fact, but I would just like Alice to answer that aspect of the fear part of being afraid that your coverage might be affected, knowing that a genetic disorder runs in your family. And I'd also like to ask a question about if you wanted to know more about, say, the disorder von Hippel-Lindau syndrome, where would you go to get information without being afraid that your coverage would be affected?
Thanks very much. Alice?
Yes, to the first question, I think that's a very realistic fear. It's true that genetic disorders can impact health insurance, and that's one of the problems in this country, that we don't have universal health insurance like all other industrialized countries. This is perhaps going to change after the election, hopefully, but it's very much related to our broken health system.
Do you know of Huntington's patients who aren't covered or can't get coverage or can't change jobs because they're fearful they won't be able to get coverage?
Yes, absolutely. If you're part of a big group, you know, then you're more protected. If you ever have to get individual health insurance or you're in a very small group, it definitely, and it's known that it's in your family even if you don't have it.
What happens if you tell your insurance company that this is in your family?
You can become uninsurable.
It's that's happened. You know that's happened?
That has definitely happened, and we've heard it from insurance agents. In fact, I think I have a quote in the book. It's the red flag that really makes somebody uninsurable. Yes.
How do they defend that?
How do the insurance companies defend it?
Yes.
They're private for-profit companies, you know, and they feel it's not in their economic interest, and that's why we need to have national health insurance.
Alice Wexler, let's go from the political to the literary for a moment with a very interesting question, email question from Amy in Maryland. She says, this is a fascinating discussion about a topic I know little about. I was surprised, however, to hear about the woman in the early 1800s who walked into the sea. It sounds almost exactly like The End of the Awakening, a novel by Kate Chopin, written around 1899. Do you know if that story is the basis of Chopin's novel? Are there other literary interpretations of the disease? And how do you think art might help us understand the effect diseases have on individuals, families, and society?
Ooh, what a great, great comment and question. Yes, I have thought about that, Kate Chopin novel, The Awakening. I think that the characters' motives in The Awakening were quite different, but certainly there's a parallel there, definitely, with the last scene of The Awakening and the beginning of my book. I think art can play a wonderful part, and in fact, there are a number of novelists and writers such as Ruth Rendell, Joanna Scott, and Octavia Butler, who's a wonderful science fiction writer, who have all created characters with Huntington's. Even Eric Segal wrote a book called The Prizes. There are quite a lot of fiction out there. There are filmmakers who have used Huntington's disease, and visual artists as well. I think that's a fabulous way to communicate what this illness is about.
The show has a very literary audience, very literate audience. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-433-8850. Right back to the phones. And Laura from Indiana. Hi, Laura.
Hi. My question is, actually the situation is I have a cousin who's 11 years old whose father died of Huntington's disease in his 40s. He is 11, and he is in the later stages of Huntington's himself. And I was wondering, he's actually dying, and he's only 11. So I was wondering, what is the chances or the statistics of someone in their younger years, such as this child, contracting Huntington's, or the, I guess the gene activating, and having a child have Huntington's disease?
Yeah, important question. About 10% of all cases of Huntington's occur in children. So it is fairly rare, and obviously very tragic to have a child so young to have this illness.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Laura. Appreciate it. Alice Wexler, your sister wrote the foreword to this book,
yes.
And I want to read a few of her words. Our fate, she wrote, is not in our genes, irrevocable and inexorable as the illness may be. In our current era of romantic fascination with DNA, this fact alone is a source of hope. And the book, she says, gives us a mirror backward and a path forward. There's a lot behind your sister's words. Want to talk about that?
Yes, I think we have a tendency to think our fate is in our genes. And I think it's very important. She and I both feel that it's what we make of what we've been given. You know, that we can make choices. We can't control whether we inherit a Huntington's gene or not, but we can choose how we're going to live with this condition at risk or with the disease. There are many choices that we can make, and I think she wanted to also make a statement against the kind of determinism. We hear too much of this in this day and age.
Well, we've been talking here, Alice Wexler, one of our producers points out that Congress passed just this spring a law outlawing health insurance discrimination based on genetic disease. What do you know about that?
I think it's a very important step forward against discrimination. I think we have to make sure it gets enforced. That will be the challenge ahead of us. And again, if we had national health insurance, this would not be such an issue today.
Here's an email question from Scott, an MD, who asks, could you comment on whether a person with a family history or a known genetic diagnosis of Huntington's or a similar disease should be eligible for jobs such as airplane pilot or presumably other sensitive positions, but especially, he writes, if public funds are used to train the individual?
Yes, I believe in occupations like an airline pilot, they get tested regularly to make sure that they can function well. The crucial thing is, can you function? You know, are you a high-functioning person? And as long as you can pass that test and as long as you can function, I think whether you're at risk for Huntington's does not matter. Huntington's doesn't develop instantly. It's a very slow, gradual thing. And the important thing is that people in those kinds of positions have to be functioning well, and a genetic test is not going to be is not going to tell you that.
We've got a few minutes left, Alice Wexler. You've lived with this disease in your family. You walk around with the knowledge that you have a 50-50 chance of getting it. You've spent years writing this book. As you looked into the book and thought deeply about this, what surprised you most? What did you discover about the disease, yourself, the rest of us?
One thing that I discovered that did surprise me was the pervasiveness of eugenic attitudes in this country and even among doctors and health professionals. So that was a very disturbing finding to me.
In what time frame are you talking about? You're talking about present day?
No, up until maybe the 1970s. I think it really started to change then. But that was definitely a surprise to me. And also the extent to which misinformation gets repeated over and over again in even medical journals when people don't go back to the original sources, which is why I wanted to go back to the 19th century, to the 18th century, to this woman who walked in to see the original documents, evidence.
Alice Wexler, author of The Woman Who Walked Into the Sea, Huntington's and the Making of a Genetic Disease. Thanks so much for your time today and for all your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I wish you a very, very long and very, very healthy life. I hope you write a lot more books.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.